Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Long last, the movie you've been waiting for. A thrilling look at the history of our great nation.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the Confederate States of America.
Learn how we protected the noble institution of slavery.
A new generation of young people are excited now about owning Negroes.
Watch Subjugation at its finest and the master race rise to unprecedented heights.
So let's start with Jupiter and his family.
Versatility is the key with Jupiter. He's healthy, well-mannered, loyal, smart, but not uppity.
Oh, and what a litter of pickaninnies she's had. As with all SSN products, we can either break up Jupiter's family for you, or you can have them as a set. So let the bidding begin.
A quick trial was convened. And former President Lincoln was convicted of war crimes against the Southern nation.
Now I too am a Negro.
Introducing the Shackle, the revolutionary new way of servant monitoring. The Shackle will stand up to the most strenuous of escape attempts, perfect for children, and at the low, low price of $49.95.
Hitler proposed that America join with him in a final solution.
But he did create a provision allowing a small number of Jews to remain on the reservation here on Long Island.
Slavery, like nothing else, is what defines us as a people, as a nation. Amen.
Welcome to another episode of the Projection Booth. I'm Rob St. Mary, and with me is co-host Mike White.
Howdy.
Now, this week we're talking about Kevin Willmott's 2005 mock doc, The Confederate States of America. The film is a Ken Burns-like documentary telling what would have happened if the South would have won the Civil War. For example, slavery would still be in effect. Black people would be treated as second-class citizens, and other social nastiness would still be the norm. Willmott uses many of the design concepts and effects used in Ken Burns' classic PBS documentary, The Civil War, in order to make his point, and that plays as sort of the framework that the filmmaker uses for reenactments, some Photoshop techniques, and even actual archival footage that gives the CSA a realism that he is able to make some solid points that even though the South may have lost the war in history, their ideas may have won in the public political arena that we live in today. But of course, that's just scratching the surface, Mike. So when did you get a chance to first see this?
You know, this one was a weird one. I received this on DVD from a friend of mine, just kind of like it was in a package of movies that he was sending to me, and it just said CSA on it. I had no idea what it was, and I hadn't heard about the film, though I probably should have. Popped it in, and it was great. Just it was it really took me. You know, I am a huge fan of pseudo documentaries. So seeing this, it just really was like, okay, this is a really smart way that they did this. How about yourself?
I actually saw it at a friend's house when I was living in Grand Rapids. This was probably 5 or 6 years ago when it came out on DVD. It was part of a movie night for a group that I belonged to out there. It was like a free thinkers group, a bunch of, you know, atheists and other heathens that would get together and drink and have philosophical discussions. And they showed this movie and I was just completely blown away by it because I had seen the Ken Burns stuff. And there's so many like Ken Burns sort of parody bits in this that's so good in terms of, you know, the use of the little zoom in on the photos and the voiceover and all this stuff. So it's like if you know Ken Burns' work, not only just the Civil War, but all of his work, you can really get an idea for what he's trying to go at.
The candidates need no introduction. The Democratic candidate, Vice President Richard M. Nixon, and the Republican candidate, Senator John F. Kennedy. And now for the first opening statement by Senator John F. Kennedy.
In the election of 1960, and with the world around us, the question is whether the world will exist, half slave or half free, whether it will move in the direction of freedom, in the direction of the road that we are taking, or whether it will move in the direction of slavery. If we do well here, if we meet our obligations, if we're moving ahead, then I think freedom will be secure around the world. If we fail, then freedom fails.
It was what many had predicted of an Irish Catholic and a Northerner to boot. Critics had called Kennedy a black Republican, obviously bringing up the image of Abraham Lincoln and the abolitionists of the past.
Slaves knew Kennedy was sympathetic to their plight. He could not directly come out and advocate its end, but everyone knew that if the opportunity arose, Kennedy would emancipate.
I also really like the ideas in the film. It kind of works on several different levels in that it's kind of like Amazon Women on the Moon in a way, where they're trying to show you a movie, but they keep cutting into it with commercials. The idea is that you're watching this on a TV station and they keep going to breaks. And then these commercials are really interesting as well.
Well, commercials and then also some of the news footage, because they have a news break during the movie. And I love the way that they're telling a narrative at the same time as they're telling this kind of fake documentary.
This is Newsbreak. I'm Jeb Boone. Confederate Express, the nation's leading shipper, issued a warning today that house servants are using the service to, in their words, overnight themselves to freedom.
There was this one fella, shipped his whole family, wife and two kids, up north in a box labeled Home Entertainment Center. Another big tip, check for air holes.
Back after this.
I think they did a really great job with the way that, you know, things kind of move forward and move back at the same time. You know, you've got one character, this politician character, who you see during the film as kind of a voice of authority. And then as the movie progresses, he keeps coming back into it. And then also his family had been so involved with all of the things that had been happening since the Civil War that you kind of, you know, he's the real through line in this entire film, which I thought was a really smart way of telling a story.
When this country was the United States of America, slaves built this capital.
Washington and Davis.
Today,
they made our empire.
We preserved.
Others would.
Reports soon surfaced. Fauntroy would run for the Democratic presidential nomination.
This is John Ambrose Fauntroy, and I approve this message.
Not only, you know, you're 100% right when you say that, you know, it was speaking to the whole Ken Burns way of documentary filmmaking, but then, you know, I've never actually seen a Ken Burns film, but I've seen his stuff pilfered and used so much by other documentary filmmakers that he kind of rewrote a lot of the language of documentary films while he was doing this. And he probably took some things, you know, obviously from the past, but everybody wanted to be Ken Burns after Ken Burns' stuff started coming out. So that the way that Kevin Wilmot is using this kind of same film language to tell his story, I thought was very clever as well.
And the commercials are great, too. I mean,
oh yeah,
they're very much in line with what we had talked about before with something like Putney Swope, Saturday Night Live type parody.
Can you stand it, boss? Can you take, oh, dim microscopic shiners gleaming your teeth as? Go now. That's it. All right. Now that's the power of Ducky. Ducky.
For a shine that's jigaboo bright.
And the real sadness of it is, I mean, I knew some of them as I was watching that they were based on real things. But in the end, he basically shows you that all of these things that he brought up are actually real products that were before or even still on sale today.
Yeah, that denouement really is an eye-opener, because as I was watching the film, I kept thinking of previous, you know, products or things that I had seen. You know, I'm not a big fan of the movie Ghost World, but one of the things I do like about it is some of the racist advertising that they find and they're talking about in the movie. But it reminded me, you know, even like growing up downriver, there was a Sambo's right there on North Line, or no, on Eureka between Ellen and Rocco. So I used to eat at Sambo's quite a few times, and I was always amazed going in there. And I mean, even as a little kid looking at these menus going, this isn't right, man. What the hell? How can you have this restaurant called Sambo's? And I'm like, what is, you know, my mom would tell me, oh yeah, well, there's this story of the little black Sambo. And yeah, I couldn't believe that this place existed for so long and that these other things are still going on.
And I'll give you an example. I mean, obviously, this isn't an American example. This is a British example. My mother's from Scotland, and when I was a kid, we used to get Robertson's jellies and jams, and we would buy them here. My grandmother would go visit back home, and she would come back from Scotland, and she would have Robertson's. And for years, I mean, literally for like 50, 60, 70 years, Robertson's used to have on their label what they called a gollywog. And what a gollywog is much like Sambo, it's a black character with big white eyes and red lips. And what you would do with Robertson's is you could save the proof of purchase seals and you would send them in and they would send you gollywog badges, which were originally they were dolls. They actually had individual dolls, and then they went to pins. They were like little pins. And it would be this character dressed up like a firefighter or cop or whatever. I mean, but it was this big-eyed, afro hair, big red-lipped, stereotypical black character. And this went on up until the 90s, because I remember when I was a little kid, all of a sudden it just disappeared from the jars. And I remember reading these stories about how the company decided that it was time to get rid of that because they were getting protests and they realized that, you know, at the time, England was a much more multicultural society than it was when they first started doing that around the turn of the century.
You think?
but that's the thing, is these commercials that he puts in here and the way that the film is structured, the way the CSA is structured is so interesting. And the ultimate core idea that he wants to bring forward, I think, is that did the South really win? Granted, we don't have slavery in America, but did the South really win? And I kind of want to talk about this a little bit from your perspective. I mean, obviously, we're film guys and we're not, you know, doing, you know, crossfire here or whatever. This isn't a political discussion. But I mean, when you look at American politics post-Civil War, and especially maybe the last 50 to 75 years, can you see for yourself how maybe these ideas that came out of the South are still with us today?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny because it would have been very ironic had he had a scene of someone still flowing the regular American flag, you know, the stars and stripes. Thank you. Having somebody flying the stars and stripes right next to the Confederate flag, because that goes on right now and you see the Confederate flag still like crazy. And it would have been kind of neat had he had a scene of people getting really up in arms had somebody been flying the, you know, stars and stripes over a state capitol, or, you know, just even having it on their truck or something. You know, it would have been very interesting had he had something like that. I guess maybe rather than a truck, people would have, you know, put it on their Lexus or something like that. But yeah, it was interesting that he not only is talking about racism against blacks, but he's also talking about Latinos and Asians and really getting into the whole history of America when it comes to outside immigration and anyone who isn't, you know, WASPy. And I really appreciated that he did that, because that stuff is still going on today. I mean, we look at, you know, Arizona and just the way that, that people are being profiled down there. And, you know, there was just a story in the news last week about somebody who is being talked to about their racial profiling. So, yeah, it definitely is going on. And he's got a whole commercial in there about, you know, is somebody passing for white, you know, call up and report your neighbor kind of thing.
It's like now 150 years after the Civil War, and we're still dealing with a lot of this idea of regionalism balance. You're still dealing with ideas that are feeling that black people are still second class in America, because you can have these things that are still products that are still sold. with their face on it, or the way people are treated, or the opportunities that they get. And I think he does it in a really interesting way, and especially with that quote that opens the film from Shaw that says, if you're going to tell people the truth, you better make them laugh or they'll kill you. And I think that that's really what he tries to do in this. And I think he does a really great job with it.
He definitely gets some laughs, but it is very sobering. And I like that as he's going through and showing this, you know, documentary that's being shown on British television or was made in England and being shown on American television. And, you know, you've got the nice warning that children and servants shouldn't watch this film because of its disturbing ideas. I like that, you know, it's the whole history of the United States post, end of Civil War beyond, and that just no matter how many things have changed and are different because the South won the war, obviously there are some radical changes when it comes to what happened to Abraham Lincoln, those kind of things, and I love that part. I love the D.W. Griffith reenactment there, but post that, really, things didn't change that much. I mean, even up until the 60s, you've got Kennedy still running for president, and you've got, you know, like you would think there would be a much more radical shift in everything that had happened. But according to this documentary within CSA, you really are following a lot of the same lines. And I think that kind of speaks to, you know, how different things are, but yet they're still very much the same.
The aspects that I also like about this movie is the fact that he uses so many different devices and ideas that are done so well. You have things like 1950s sort of like educational films, the commercials, obviously, the Griffith reenactment style silent film, the Photoshop images, things like that. I mean, his use of ideas and nailing the tone of these things. I mean, there's like 20 different things that he's doing, and he's just nailing the look. He's nailing the tone of these things so that they seem so authentic. And that's the thing that I think is so great about the actual art of this film.
Yeah, I think had he had another, you know, few million dollars, it would have been absolutely seamless. But I kind of like that it isn't seamless. I like that you can tell that these are, you know, reenactments and him kind of playing with the form and everything. I especially like not only the Griffith scene, but also the scene later on when you have the Shakespearean actor who's in blackface delivering the lines to Jefferson Davis. Is it Jefferson Davis? I believe it is, about how things should be set up so that Northerners feel comfortable with slavery again. And he's just delivering this speech in this very, you know, stentorian tone. I just absolutely love that.
The various different film ideas that are also in there that are really interesting is there's a whole section where instead of it being like the Red Scare, there's like an abolitionist scare in the 50s. And there's this whole sort of like invasion of the body snatchers kind of idea where it's like, oh, how do I know that my husband is racially pure and all of this stuff and the idea of race mixing and all of this. It's just really interesting how he's able, like I said, to take these various ideas and distill sort of the essence of what these ideas were in terms of media history and put them into this film. And it's so nice to see and it's so well done.
Definitely. I'm not sure. I think I'm of the two of us, much more the Philip K. Dick fan of both of us. But I'm not sure if you've ever read The Man in the High Castle.
No.
It's one of Dick's probably, I'd say it's probably top three books. And one of the neat things in that is it's very much an alternative history kind of book as well. And it's as if Japan and Germany had won World War II. But it's neat because inside of that quote-unquote reality of Japan and Germany winning the war, there's a book that has come out and that tells a different story as if they had won the war. And basically, that is our truth inside of that book versus the truth of the Man in the High Castle, you know, their storyline. So it's just kind of, it's a nice way that they play with the form as well. And it's always good to see that kind of the interplay between what we consider real and what other people consider real. And this one, I think, is, with CSA, he does such a good job of, you know, what people accept as the truth, you know, as far as our history, and then what really might have been going on the whole time. As you were saying, did the South really win the war? Is there still this kind of stuff? Because he's bringing up all of these points that are really kind of saying maybe there is this stuff that should have, you know, went away when the North won the war.
And it's part of, and I want to have a discussion about this after the interview with Kevin Wilmont, about sort of mock docs and various mock docs that we like. As a matter of fact, I don't think we've ever done it since I've been on the show, is bring back that old top five thing that you used to do in the early episodes of the show. So I really like to get into that and have sort of a broader discussion on what you can do with a mock doc.
All right. I will let the drummer know that he's going to come back during the second half of the show. But first, we're going to take a break and come back with an interview from Kevin Wilmont, the director, writer, and producer of CSA, the Confederate States of America.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340 KAB.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
And I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst f***ing piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
I wanted a career working firsthand with doctors in a professional setting that didn't take 4 long years.
I wanted to help all God's creatures, great and small, but my grades just weren't high enough for medical school. But now, I'm on the fast track to success.
Train for a new and exciting career at CI, the Cartwright Institute for the Study of Freedom Illnesses. In just months, not years, CI can train you for a rewarding career as an overseer, paddy roller, servant monitor, breeder, or get an associate's degree in e-slave accounting. Perform medical experiments. Learn the nature of freedom diseases. You'll be proud working firsthand with doctors tackling the challenges of Negro peculiarities. Become that person you always knew you could be. Call CI today. Classes are forming, so call right now.
I've always been kind of a history guy and had written a lot of kind of history screenplays. You know, the notion of what would happen if the South had won the Civil War was always kind of something I had in the back of my mind. And then, you know, I think I became kind of frustrated with Hollywood and its approach to the issue of slavery, you know, and you know, that's a kind of a, you know, impossible subject matter to deal with in Hollywood. You know, they just really don't make films. You know, make many films about, you know, dramatic history things, period. But slavery is just one that's almost totally off limits. And, you know, when I'd have meetings in Hollywood for different things, they'd say, well, you know, Beloved didn't do well and Amistad didn't do well. And so, you know, I was really frustrated with, you know, the whole notion of not being able to really examine this huge part of American history. And so I try to think of a new way to approach the subject matter, you know, to try to kind of open it up in terms of dialogue and in terms of how people looked at it, in terms of it's not stodgy, old, stale history, you know, but something that's really provocative and really, you know, could hopefully, I think, grab an audience.
Talking about that, obviously, Hollywood not interested. I mean, outside of the few films that you mentioned, it's not a topic that really comes up. So how hard was it to try and get people interested in giving you the money to do it? Because the way that you approach it is such a unique take as well on top of it.
Well, I didn't approach anybody for the money. I did it almost entirely. I shot it for about $30,000. And it took me about 3 years to shoot it. So I would shoot it a little bit at a time. And almost no one was paid. I only spent money on the things I had to buy or the things I had to spend money on. But, one thing I kind of figured out a while back was that you waste more time asking people to give you money for something than you would be trying to shoot the movie on your own. And when it comes to certain things, it's been my experience anyway that you know, asking permission, and that's kind of what it is in a way, you know, asking permission for people who are really, you know, not interested in your vision is just a good way to never get your film made. So what I did was I really concentrated all my efforts on you're really just trying to make the movie I wanted to make. And, the tough thing about it takes 3 years to shoot it. The good thing about it is that it's your vision and that, you know, I got to tell the story I wanted to tell in the way I wanted to tell it. Obviously, you know, I had certain constraints with budget and so forth. But as a whole, I felt like, you know, that was the movie I wanted to make.
And from that, putting it together, you know, the writing of it and everything, you know, what did you look to as inspiration? I mean, were there certain films, filmmakers, books? I mean, you obviously had an interest in history.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm a huge Woody Allen fan. People kind of find that odd. But, I just am a big fan of his and just really admire, you know, the fact that he makes a lot of different kind of movies. And I see myself trying to do that as well. And you know, Zelig was a big influence. I think when I saw Zelig for the first time, you know, I knew what he was, you know, it had me fooled for a little bit, you know, and I tried to do that with CSA in terms of, you know, trying to really tell the story in a way that people that didn't know history very well would have to go, wait a minute, what's going on? What's going on here? You know? And I really enjoyed that with Zelig. And so I think the inside joke of how these documentaries look and how the Ken Burns, the one I was specifically kind of satirizing was the Civil War with Ken Burns. And so, you know, just trying to really emulate that in a way that would really take people to that series and to those kind of documentaries was really important to me. And then finding the humor in it, you know, not based in, you know, just trying to be funny, but based in the absurdity of the truth of it all, you know. And that was the criteria I had in writing the script, was that and there's very few just straight out jokes. There's a few, but most of them are jokes that are based, the humor is based in the truth of that history.
You know, it would be one thing just to satirize Ken Burns' style, but you go way beyond that. I mean, in terms of creating these commercials and creating these sort of parodies of certain eras of film and newsreel and even like something that maybe D.W. Griffith shot. So, I mean, how did you kind of like come to these ideas and sort of break down, okay, this is what you need to have in order to make this look good, like make a commercial look real or like sure. A D.W. Griffith silent film look like that. So,
right.
I mean, there was a certain amount of research involved in making, to pull that off, correct?
Oh, very much so. And you know, and you're also doing it, you know, making choices based in your budget constraints as well. So, you know, I had to, you know, when I would make a choice to kind of, well, this is something I want to satirize, you know, like the Griffith commercial, you know, and my cinematographer, Matt Jacobson, is a big, you know, test. I have to give him a great deal of credit in the film because, you know, he really, he's great at capturing those at historical looks. And I, you know, without someone like Matt, I couldn't have pulled it off. But, you know, a big part of it was, you know, you've got to know what it looks like. And then you've got to kind of know how that relates to the joke of it and to the kind of, you know, the pointing out the absurdity of the CSA in this context. And, for instance, with the Griffith film, you know, Griffith is, you know, a big part of was a big part of the problem. And, you know, he made this amazingly great film and kind of sold the Klan to the nation, you know. And so in kind of examining the CSA, he has to be on the list. And so, you know, you kind of then look at how you're going to do that. And I was able to find a reenactment group. Being a filmmaker in Kansas, one of the great things is that, you know, I have access to the country. The country is right outside. And I have access to reenactors, and I have access to a lot of things that would be a lot more expensive if I was a New York City filmmaker or L.A. filmmaker. So, all of that really lent itself well to making that choice. And then it's about, you know, nailing the look. And so we shot it on film. And then we ran the film through the projector and then held a Brillo pad over the film to kind of age it and scratch it. And then Matt did a lot of research in terms of, and then we hand cranked the film when we shot it. We had a little small hand crank film when we shot it. And then a former student of mine is a real silent movie, I would say aficionado in many ways, and he did a really great job of recapturing the look of Griffith's title cards. So it was a combination of all of those things that, you know, and that's the kind of detail that it took to, I think, really pull those off in a way that isn't just funny, but because the joke isn't funny if you don't nail the details of it all. And I think the thing that people admire about the film is that we took the time to nail the details of what those movies and what those, if it was a commercial or if it was a clip from an old movie or if it was a political ad, whatever it might have been, that we took the time to try to make the details right.
The actual footage that you use, you know, obviously newsreel footage and things like that, and then you add to it and create your own to some extent. Did you have any issues when you went to go clear certain things? And then people asked you, well, you know, how is it going to be used? And then you're like, well, I'm going to use it out of context to make a point. Did they ever scratch their head or go, no, I'm not going to give you clearance?
Well, I only had one problem, and it was out of all the footage, and we used a lot of different footage. The only one I had was I was trying to get some footage from, it was a Dallas TV station about President Kennedy. And it was some really great footage of when he landed that day at Love Field. And it was local TV news footage, not the typical kind of stuff you see in most documentaries about JFK on that day. And that was the only footage I was not able to get. But other than that, I was able to land all the footage. So I was very fortunate in that sense.
We talked about this, you know, balancing of truth and fiction. Now, it could be real easy to just kind of go off the rails, make it 100% pure fiction. But the reason why the film works for me, at least, is the fact that, you know, these concepts that you put in there are real. So what was sort of the balance for you between, you know, telling the history and telling all these things that have sort of continued to happen? Because to me, the film is so much about contemporary society as it is about what a possible victory for the South would have been.
Well, that was you got the whole thing. That was the entire point. Was really the thesis for me was the South did win the Civil War, and they did. Obviously, they didn't win on the battlefield, but they won in their attempt to hold on to their way of life. And you know, so that was the criteria. That was the controlling idea of the film, was to try to make choices that really made that clear, that the whole notion of, well, what would happen if the South did win? Well, they did. And the thing I always love to talk about is one of the best examples of that is where I live, Lawrence, Kansas. And, you know, it's not the Mississippi Board of Education case that desegregates the schools in America. It's the Topeka Board of Kansas, case that desegregates schools. And, you know, and where I live, Lawrence, you know, KU, John Brown, Bleeding Kansas, we love to celebrate the free state here. Yet after the Civil War, you know, Lawrence becomes segregated. And where I teach, KU was segregated. And so Kansas, which, you know, the Jayhawkers, everything is about the free state. And somehow when the war ends, we become a segregation state. And so how did that happen? And the only thing you can conclude is that we adopted the Southern way of life. They didn't adopt our way of life from the North. And so in that sense, it's bigger than the South. And that, you know, the CSA, for me, becomes a metaphor that's more about what America do you want? And that seems to be kind of the big metaphor that I think that is what the nation always deals with, which is, you know, the CSA kind of limits freedom and the USA grants freedom. And then what country do you want? Do you want the USA or the CSA? And we tend to go back and forth about this. And it's kind of, you know, we grant freedom to certain people. We just recently started to maybe grant freedom to gay people, you know, and then there's places in America that want to restrict that freedom. So, you know, the CSA for me becomes a much bigger metaphor. It kind of expands from slavery and the African-American experience and goes into a little bit of everything. And so that's kind of what I learned from the film. I mean, that was not what I set out. That it's not what I fully understood in the beginning, but one of the cool things about when you make a film like this is that you kind of, hopefully you discover something. And that was kind of, for me, what I discovered for myself.
Obviously, you know, as a black man, as a filmmaker, you're making this movie dealing with issues that are very close to you, very close to the community and things like that. Were there certain things that you decided that, you know, I can't go there with this?
Right.
You know, were there certain limits or were you just sort of like, I'm taking the gloves off and I'm going to do whatever I need to do? I mean, where sort of was that line for you? Was there something that you were just like, I'm not going to touch that?
Well, the criteria for me was always on anything, any choice was that, is it true? And if it was true, I felt like I had the right to examine it, you know? And true is a obviously a big word, you know, what exactly does that mean? But I think for me, it was like, I felt like I could tell any joke or make fun of anything if I was, you know, giving you some truth behind the joke. And that you know, that was what I was a huge Richard Pryor fan as a kid. And the great thing about Richard Pryor was, you know, was that most of his jokes had this element of truth to them. And that was the criteria I tried to use, which was, you know, if it was true, if I could back it up historically, if I could back it up from our way of life, if I could back it up culturally, if I could back it up with concrete examples of how this plays out in society in various ways, I felt like I had the right to examine it. And I think that for me is like the criteria that I use in terms of satire, period, really. You know, if you're not learning something from the satire, I mean, I think that's what makes it funny. And it's also what the audience kind of enjoys, because if it's true, you laugh at it because it's true, you know? And so that really gave me a great, and now there were some things that, you know, I remember we have a shot in the film of some footage of a terrorist attack that the so-called JBU does. And it was right, we had just put that in the film right around 9/11. And we kind of had that discussion afterwards, you know, about, well, is this too close to home? Is this going to be offensive? And I've never had anybody say, you know, this is, you know, offends me because of what happened at 9/11. I think one of the things we try to do is to say we're going to make a movie for smart people, and we're not going to play down. We're not going to explain things. We're not going to try to, you know, dummy it down on any kind of real level. We're going to expect people to kind of step up to it. And you know, that's been one of the most rewarding things about it, because you know, I think people really enjoyed that part of the film.
As for the casting, one of the things I wanted to ask is, was everyone an actor or did you have regular people? Because I've seen other pseudo-docs, and at times it feels like the cast is trying too hard. You can actually see them acting, and yes. I don't get that in this.
Well, that's good to hear. I have a little bit of everybody in this film. You know, I have, for instance, the two historians. The black historian, the black female historian, is an actor. But the white male historian is a good buddy of mine who is an actual historian. And he has a beautiful Mississippi accent. And I think it was a great choice because, you know, it's that combination of using actors in certain places, and I tried to use them in places where actors would have actually been used. So, for instance, I mainly use actors in the commercials, or I use them in the clips from Hollywood movies, things like that. And then the things that are more like documentary footage or real people kind of things, I used more regular folks who I thought just kind of fit the role.
We talked a little bit about sort of the production, but for you, is there anything that you were thinking about in terms of putting it together beyond it taking you 3 years to do it? What was sort of the hardest thing to do?
Well, you know, obviously the 3 years, you know, is a big part of it. But I think that the way the production really went was that taking that much time also allowed us to try to get all the details right and to kind of think and then rethink things and to kind of discover our abilities and the things that we couldn't pull off. And so, when you shoot, you know, when you kind of work towards shooting a scene and you've got 3 weeks or whatever, you've got to then put together what it takes to pull this scene off. And that may mean we have to go to out of town to a location where something exists that we can use, or we've got to find the right wardrobe, or we've got to find, you know, the right actors, or whatever it might be, you know, and you're doing this for literally kind of no money. That actually is a big asset, because time, the worst thing about time is that it takes forever. The good thing about time is it gives you a chance to, for no budget, to kind of do it right. And so we utilize that to our advantage a great deal, I think. You know, Matt, my cinematographer, talks about, we go out and shoot 60 seconds of a movie. You know, let's go out and shoot another 60 seconds today, or another 2 minutes of the movie. And you know you're making a feature. And so, you know, and then I think that you have to keep people energized. And one thing about this structure of this story was that we shot the historians in like 2 days, 1 day apiece. So that was kind of like the base coat of the movie. So I could see the entire movie through them, through their comments and through the things that I had written that they were going to say. And so that worked, I have to say that worked very well. So then it was like you then fill in all the gaps after that. And so whether it's a commercial or an educational film or whatever, you know, a piece of newsreel, whatever it was, you could then start to fill in all those gaps that you saw that existed there. But it was very encouraging to the crew and to all of us, because you could always kind of see the whole movie in a way. And that's something that can keep you going over a long period of time.
Were there any things that you really wanted to do but you couldn't do because you just didn't have the time or the money, or maybe sure. things that had to get cut out because it just didn't rhyme with the flow of the film?
Well, there's always things that you have to compromise a little bit, and there's always things that you look at and go, well, I wish I could have done this better or this different or something. I mean, there's some things that I think the low budget really lent itself well to that in some ways, if you had money, it might be worse, you know? If sometimes money can be a deficit and not a benefit. You know, there are a few things that you know, we cut out that, you know, were good bits and stuff, I think. But, you know, as a whole, I'm I don't mean this in the egotistical way. I don't mean this in terms of me so much. But I'm, you know, because the movie kind of becomes something that's outside of you at some point. And that's how I feel about the film now. It's kind of something that you know, is outside of me. It's owned kind of by all of us that worked on it. And in that sense, I'm very satisfied with the film. You know, I think that, you know, we kind of did what we needed to do, and we kind of we kind of got it like it should have been done. So I don't have any huge complaints about it. You know, I mean, there's always things that you wish you'd have thought about differently or something like that. But as a whole, and I don't say this about all my movies, but in terms of this, I don't go back and look at it and you're disappointed about scenes or something like that. It's one of the few things that has been pretty satisfying.
Were there any scenes that you had to cut that would have been, like by themselves might be interesting, but just didn't seem to fit or you weren't able to do that kind of stick out in your mind?
There was a couple things that we had that were designed differently that we had to change. And one of that's kind of funny. One of them was the scene with the Contrary commercial for Contrary, the medicine that makes you control slaves, allows you to control slaves. And we had that scene earlier in the movie, but when we would show it to kind of audiences early on, it was so harsh that people shut down after that. The audience just kind of it just took all the oxygen out of the room, and so we had to move it later to the film, and that's when we kind of discovered that, and it was always designed this way, but it was really confirmed by that response, was that we needed to kind of gradually up the level of the bite on the film. And it was always designed that way, but it was really, really confirmed. And you become used to these things yourself. And I believe we should be able to talk about everything. So I'm kind of not the guy sometimes to measure these things. But that was a big lesson there. It's kind of a funny story for you. A guy called me up one time and said he'd seen the film in Omaha and a bunch of skinheads were in the audience. And the movie starts out, and they're hooping and hollering and laughing kind of at black people and not with black people, not at the audience, but kind of laughing at the slavery, And they were laughing and laughing, and as the movie progressed, they got quieter and quieter, and eventually they walked out. And that was exactly how it was designed, to kind of lure you in with this kind of, oh, this is going to be one of those kind of racial spoof movies, and we're going to kind of laugh at black folks and that kind of thing or whatever, and kind of wink and a nod toward the audience. And then the wink and a nod kind of disappears, and suddenly you're left with kind of the reality of all this. And finally, at the end, when you get the card at the end that tells you that all the commercials were based on real products and that this is everything in the movie's kind of basically been true, the joke's on you now for not knowing. And so that was kind of, we'd always hoped that it worked that way, but it was the skinhead example was one of the best in terms of, that if we had not designed it that way, it could have really gone off the tracks.
That was what I was going to ask, and it's a perfect transition as to, how was the reaction when you first started to show it? And then did you find different reactions based on where you showed it?
Sure. We premiered at Sundance, and it was really interesting because the first screening at Sundance, and, Sundance is liberal filmmaker, so-called progressive, cool folks, right? And they were kind of not knowing what to say, there were some big fans, and then there were some people that didn't quite know how to take it. And Mario and Melvin Van Peebles were in the audience. And Melvin Van Peebles stood up and said, "I'm sure that people want to know what I think about this movie." And he said that this is exactly what I wanted to see happen when I started making movies in the 70s. And that really kind of changed the tone of the room, because I think that with Hollywood, they're always waiting for someone to tell them what they think, And when Melvin said that, it just kind of let everybody know this is hip, this is cool, this is something that the way you feel is okay. And there was someone in the audience who was kind of said he was offended, and then talked about that he was from the South and all of that. And then I had somebody in that audience that came out and said that, kind of confessed to me about, having ancestors that owned slaves. So, it's a movie that kind of affects people in a bunch of different ways. I've offended liberal people. I've offended conservative people. I offend Northerners. I offend Southerners. And at the same time, all of those people have had nothing but glowing things to say about the film. And I think that's maybe the best example of what we were trying to do, and which is also probably why Hollywood doesn't make movies like this, because there's not a consensus with everything. There's not a thing that says everyone's going to love this movie. Well, you know, I knew going in that not everyone was. I had friends say, you better not make this movie because people are going to hate your guts. And I got hate mail from the film. And I got, you know, a bunch of reenactors would write me letters. And I had a Klan guy wrote me a letter. And that's, you know, I think the best examples of the reaction to the film have been speaking around the country. And these two remarks came from the local area here in Kansas City. And a guy said, both of them from former Blockbuster Video employees. And they said, I was happening to be speaking at their school. And they said to me, I worked at a Blockbuster. And these are two separate incidents. So I worked at a Blockbuster. And a guy returned your movie and he brought it in. And he said, I don't want anyone to ever rent this movie again. It's the most racist movie I've ever seen in my life. And he cracked the DVD right in front of him. And then another incident came where a guy dropped the movie off in the drop box and it was covered with shit. Well, now when I go around and speak about the film, I always tell people, well, you know, they talk about Tarantino makes edgy movies and Scorsese and Spielberg, but none of them, I think, have had people to bring their movies back and destroy them or to cover them with shit, or they've had that kind of reaction from the subject matter of one of their films. And that's probably the best compliment I've ever received.
Wow. That's just incredible. Another hard group that I think would be, and I don't know, I just wanted to ask you on this, is documentarians. Have you shown this to documentarians? Has Ken Burns seen this? And what has been the reaction from people who do legitimate documentaries, per se?
Right. Well, I think there's always, I probably offend a few of those folks, and forgive me if I do, because that's not my intent, but because I'm a big Ken Burns fan, I think he's great. His writer, Jeffrey Lewis, saw the film and wrote me and said he loved it. And so I've never heard from Ken Burns, but I don't know if he's ever seen it or even showed it to him or talked to him about it. But it was certainly not my intent to attack Ken Burns or make fun of Ken Burns. I mean, I think Ken Burns is great. But I think, as with any satire, you're kind of satiring that thing that is the kind of icon or the quintessential example of what you're satiring. And his Civil War series is the example of the documentary about the Civil War now, as far as I'm concerned. And so that's where that whole choice came from. You know, people can't get the joke if you're not familiar with what you're satirizing. But I don't know how most documentarians feel about the film. I don't know. You know, I've never had anyone tell me I'm offended that you made these kind of choices. I think some of them probably admire the fact that there's a truth element to it, because I think documentarians always struggle with that. But I don't know if they think this is effective or offensive or what for sure. No one's ever kind of written me that way. That's like a famous documentarian or someone that's noted that way. My friends that are documentarians all seem to kind of appreciate the film. So, but they're my friends.
At the end of the film, one of the title cards that says Spike Lee Presents. Can you explain how he got involved with you?
What happened was that we finished the film and we got into Sundance. And when I got into Sundance, you know, you get all these agents call you and all these folks call you. And William Morris called me, and I'd been with William Morris at one time, but was not with him anymore. So they called me and they wanted to kind of represent me and so forth. And so I was talking with them and they said, well, Spike was in the office the other day, and I told him about it. He wanted to see it. I said, would you be willing to let him see it? And I said, sure. And so he saw it and really loved it and wanted to help. And so that's when it became a Spike Lee presentation. And so he had nothing to do with the film and the creation of it, but he lent his name to the film, and I think it helped find a distributor for us. And you know, we worked really well together after that. I had a script that he really liked, and another example of something that he a script that I wrote that he really wanted to make, and we had meetings all over Hollywood for it, and it was turned down everywhere. And I don't want to sound negative here, but it's very difficult to make smart movies in Hollywood. It just is, and I don't think most people in Hollywood would kind of deny that. And even when you've got power and prestige, very difficult to get those movies made. And so, you know, the choice I've made was to kind of work outside the system, which has its own set of problems. But at least when I decide to make a film, it's my responsibility, and I'm not waiting for someone else to kind of get it. You got the burden of somehow pulling it off on your own. But when you're waiting and trying to convince people who, and I'm not saying these are bad people because they're not, but Hollywood is not designed to, it's designed to make money. And it's not really designed to do much else. It's like, you know, first comes the money, and then if we did something that changed people or moved people or made people better or entertained people, well, great. That's great, too. But the first choice is not that. I think the first choice is making money. And that's, I'm not belittling that. I think that's just the nature of it. And I think you have to accept that because you're not going to change that. And so anyway, that's where my whole approach kind of comes from, you know. And it's like I said, it's got its own set of problems, but at least you're not asking permission, you know. It's like a friend of mine actually just said to me this morning, he said, you kind of choose your own prison. And you choose your own set of rules for that prison, but at least it's yours.
What are you doing now? What's the latest things you're working on, and maybe you can share with folks?
Sure. Well, I'm just about finished with a movie that I think in some ways has a lot of links to CSA in a very, very different way. But it's called Destination Planet Negro, and it's comedy. It's, how do I describe this movie? It's black folks in 1939 have had a secret meeting to solve the Negro problem once and for all. And they decide to go to another planet. And George Washington Carver has created a rocket fuel with a peanut and a sweet potato. And so I satire the 1950s Silver Bullet rocket ship movies. And so they build a rocket ship and three astronauts take off to go to Mars. But they somehow go through some kind of time thing, and they end up here today with a black president. And then comedy hopefully ensues.
Servant etiquette and proper table linens for formal dinner parties, how to be the belle of the ball, and what to look for when buying a Chinese gardener on the next Better Homes and Plantations. It's a good thing.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. It's great talking to Kevin Wilmot. His day job actually is a professor of film at the University of Kansas. So if you're out there that way and looking to take some film classes, I'm sure he can clue you into some stuff. In the meantime, great to hear he's working on a new film. And I like the idea of it. It seems like he's going to take the CSA and kind of move it one step further and talking about sort of the reality of having the first African-American president here in America.
Yeah, it used to always be the sci-fi trope that if you had a woman or a black guy as president, you knew that you're watching a science fiction movie. So now all we have to do is get a woman in the White House, and it will complete the whole thing.
There you go. So Mock Docs, as we said, you know, let's get the drummers. Is the drummer ready over there?
Drummer's ready.
All right, come on, give it to us.
All right, there's the drum roll.
So top five mock docs, Mike. I mean, I know this is a hard category for both of us because there's so many great ones out there.
Yeah, definitely. Should we flip a coin? Who wants to go first on this one?
Let's see. M comes before R, so we'll let you go first.
All right. Age before beauty, I guess. All right. So number five, Man Bites Dog. I've only seen this film twice, I believe. And part of that reason is because it is gut-wrenching to watch this movie. And I love that there's this humor that goes along with the just horror of this film. It's a film crew following a serial killer in France, and just you get to watch how he operates just absolutely amazing. And the filmmakers themselves are terrific, and they're, you know, part of the action. And some of their earlier works are great as well. Number four, Take the Money and Run by Woody Allen. I know that this one kind of stretches a little bit, but it is presented as a mock documentary, and this one never fails to make me crack up. I mean, even when it comes to stupid sight gags, like the main character trying to play the cello in the marching band. Number three, Forgotten Silver from Peter Jackson. This one plays very well with CSA, I'd have to say, as far as the whole retelling of history when it comes to, and a lot of it through reenactments, coming to us through the very, you know, earliest filmmaker and some of the things that he did to revolutionize the film world. And it just gets crazier and crazier as it goes along. It is just brilliant. Number two, And God Spoke. You know, the Bible's got a lot of readers. Why don't we go ahead and turn that into a movie? We'll have a guaranteed audience. Love that. I love the, you know, they play around with product placement, and they're kind of ahead of the curve on a lot of stuff with that. And of course, you got Soupy Sales in it, so it doesn't get much better than that. And number one, this is Spinal Tap. Sorry, I had to do it. I've watched this movie so many times, and it never fails to make me laugh, and it's just become kind of part of the culture. So can I do some honorable mentions, or should we hold those off?
Of course, of course.
Okay, honorable mentions, Exit Through the Gift Shop. I know some people would say that this is not a mockumentary, but knowing Shepard Fairey the way that I do, I would say, yeah, definitely. But I do like that there is that kind of ambiguity around it. And the other one, before I finally shut up, is Tribulation 99, Alien Anomalies Under America by Mr. Craig Baldwin. You know, I really hate the way that we've kind of abused the term found footage when it comes to these, you know, I found a camcorder or I found a reel of film. You know, Craig Baldwin is actually making real found footage films, kind of like Bruce Conner, you know, where they would actually dumpster dive, take somebody else's, you know, real physical film media that they found and recontextualize it inside of new films. And Tribulation 99 is probably my favorite one of those. Runs about an hour, tells the quote-unquote real history of the United States. So you get to see some very interesting stuff. And again, that plays well with CSA.
As for me, my top five... Well, I have to agree with you. I had to do it. Spinal Tap. What can be said about it? You know, this is a really hard list to come up with because there's so many good ones. So my honorable mentions is probably going to be really long. So number five, Spinal Tap. I just had to do it. Number four, Real Life, which actually I'd love to do an episode on. I don't know if you've ever seen this. It's Albert Brooks's first feature, and it's a riff on American Family. I think it was called American Family. Back in the early 70s, the PBS did, where they followed around the Loud family, and this was reality TV before reality TV. And they followed the family around, and then they put this documentary together about sort of like a day in the life of an average family in America. And Albert Brooks does a similar thing, but he's constantly like goading the family into doing certain things. And it's hilarious. I think it's really underappreciated in terms of his sort of canon of films and acting when we talk about Albert Brooks. Number three, The Ruddles. I'm a huge fan of the Beatles. Really appreciate them. And that's why I appreciate The Ruddles even more. Just to have Eric Idle and Neil Innes and just have these guys make fun of the biggest band in the world, even to the point where they have a whole thing about, instead of Yoko being who Yoko was in the Ruddles documentary, she's the daughter of Hitler and started World War II. I mean, there's really, you can't go any further than that in terms of the hatred that people have had for Yoko and her breaking up the Beatles than to put a proxy in a movie that said that she her father was Hitler and he started World War II. So that's a good one. Number two, Incident at Loch Ness. Ness. I don't know how many people have seen this. It's pretty fun. It's a it's Zach Penn, who's basically known for writing some big budget films. I think he was responsible for your favorite movie, Mike, Last Action Hero.
And, oh, nice.
What it is, it's kind of a riff on Werner Herzog. So if you really love Werner Herzog, especially his documentaries, this movie is kind of a joke on it, in that Werner Herzog plays himself and he's working with Zach Penn, and they're going to go do a documentary on Loch Ness to find out the real deal about the Loch Ness monster. And Zach Penn goes out of his way to like thwart Herzog at every turn, even to the point of trying to create a fake Loch Ness monster just to make sure that when they get there, there's something for him to shoot. And then number one is probably Bob Roberts. Bob Roberts is just amazing in terms of what Tim Robbins and his crew were able to do. The music in it is so good. And matter of fact, you'll never see a soundtrack record for Bob Roberts.
Really?
Yeah, this is why, and I'll tell you why, was that Tim Robbins wrote all these songs that he was afraid it would end up basically as bump music for right-wing radio, is what I heard.
Mm.
Because the for those who don't know about Bob Roberts, the pseudo-doc, the film, is about Tim Robbins as Bob Roberts. He's a folk singer, but he's sort of the antithesis of what you would consider a folk singer to be. He's pro-establishment, pro-Wall Street, pro-business, conservative, and traps himself basically in the trappings of someone like Bob Dylan. As a matter of fact, all of the album covers that you see throughout the film are sort of riffs on Bob Dylan, sort of like the freewheeling Bob Roberts and things like that. And he writes these songs that are very much in the vein of what you would consider conservative America would like, where they have things like, I remember one of the lines is, some people will work, others will not, and they'll complain and complain and complain and complain and complain, you know. And he has this song about drugs, about like how they should, you know, anyone who does drugs should be like killed and all this. And then what you find out is he's running a Senate campaign in Pennsylvania against a long-standing senator who is played by Gore Vidal. And so there's this back and forth between them. Like, he's the old Democrat and he's like the new hip conservative guy. And then there's this whole like subtext of sort of like Iran-Contra kind of thing, that Giancarlo Esposito is this investigative reporter who finds out about, and he's trying to figure out sort of like what Bob Roberts knows about this like drug dealing and gun running thing. The thing that's also cool about it, if you're a fan of Jack Black, is that Jack Black's in the movie too. And it's one of his, probably I think his first film role. And he's really young. He looks like he's like fresh out of high school. So it's really interesting to watch. As for my honorable mentions, I'd have to say Zelig.
Oh, yeah.
Zelig was on there. That was, like I said, this is a hard list because Zelig's on there. Borat. I think Borat's really good. As a matter of fact, I probably the Ali G TV show more.
Yeah.
I was going to put F for Fake, but see, the thing is F for Fake to me is not about fake people. It's about him talking about fakery. So I didn't know if that would fit into the pseudo doc. So I put that as an honorable mention. And then obviously a movie we talked about, Punishment Park, and then also Peter Watkins, The War Game. So those were also good, but obviously not comic in that way. Much more straightforward and very thought-provoking films from Peter Watkins.
As I was watching CSA, I was reminded a lot of Series 7, The Contenders, which we had talked about before as well. And I think our one thing that we were talking about with Series 7 was maybe they should have put in some commercials, which would have kind of even heightened a little bit more of what was going on. But and you get that in CSA, which I think is really smart. As far as, you know, I was thinking too, as far as films that are complementary to Confederate States of America, there's one called In Smog and Thunder, which is a civil war that takes place in California, between Northern California and Southern California. And the whole movie is told through a lot of paintings that one guy did, kind of showing, you know, the one that comes to mind is the guy with the Oakland A's jacket on and a, you know, baseball cap and sunglasses, and he's riding a horse, and it's very much kind of taking the Civil War photos and paintings and moving those, transposing those into a modern day California. So that one is pretty cool. Then there's one called Death of a President, which I don't think it ultimately succeeds, but it, you know, points out a whole lot of stuff as far as our scapegoating and a lot of, you know, like when Oklahoma City happened, you know, the first thing that went across the news was that they were looking for a Middle Eastern person. And of course, it ends up being a fellow Michigander who had done this horrible thing, but just that kind of immediate jump to conclusions. So there's a whole lot of stuff when it comes to this documentary about the assassination of George W. Bush. And then another good one is A Day Without a Mexican, which is what if all the Mexicans in America had, you know, disappeared or just were taken out of a place, and how white America would not be able to function without that. Kind of, I think, again, speaks to CSA and the whole idea of the servants and slaves, basically, and just how reliant we are on people of color to actually make the world turn.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of great mock doc and pseudo doc out there that can really, I think, at times give us a better point of view on what the world is doing through the use of satire.
Yeah, because you get to see that funhouse mirror being held up and say, you know, that's me in the mirror. It just looks a little bit different. And so we get to see what our culture and our society is doing just through a little bit slightly warped point of view.
Okay, we're going to take a break and play a preview for next week's show.
Rock star is dead. Bobby? A groupie has disappeared, and millions are missing.
I think that somebody's trying to rip my company off.
Those were his kind of odds. His name? Ford Fairlane.
Hey, it's Ford Fairlane!
Hey, what are your names, Neil and Bob? Is that like what you do, huh?
A detective who's so smooth.
What is it they call you?
Precocious. Combustionable.
He's aerodynamic.
Hey.
Kooky. Everyone knows him.
Hey, you're that guy. The private eye.
You're a poet and didn't know it.
Everyone owes him.
Take this, Ford.
Well, money's fine, really. I need cash, moolah, wampum, dead presidents, Michael Jackson, Gerald Ford.
See, that's the difference between a great investigator like me and a piece of spam like you.
Spam?
And nothing they say.
You're a piece of spam. That's what I think of you.
Can throw him.
Mr. Fairlane, when I was 11, I walked in on my father and the Shetland pony he gave me for my 10th birthday. Does that excite you?
I don't know. I never met your father.
But this case can put him back.
I don't need money.
In the black.
I need questions answered. Question number one. Can I have some money?
But when your beat is the music business.
Let me see this chick around.
Is this a trick question?
You keep notes on everyone.
Got you.
Priscilla Presley.
Who?
I wouldn't trust that babe as far as I could bowl her.
Ed O'Neill.
Booty tag. Booty tag.
Robert Englund. Tone Loke. Gilbert Gottfried. Sheila E. And Wayne Newton.
What?
Yes, Wayne Newton.
And I gotta defeat a baby.
Oh, he seems nice.
Andrew Dice Clay.
Oh!
Is Ford Fairlane.
Shall I drive his man?
In a movie so hot.
Got something cooking in the microwave?
Get out!
You'd better bring protection.
No, oh, maybe it was just a pot pie.
Ford Fairlane.
Are you mad?
I'm ecstatic!
Coming in July to theaters everywhere.
No, I ain't got you.
That was a preview from next week's show, Rennie Harlan's The Adventures of Ford Fairlane. Boy, talking about going from one extreme to the other. Make sure to tune in when we talk to the screenwriter, Daniel Waters, the original Ford Fairlane story writer, Wex Weiner, and hopefully a whole lot more. So I want to thank this week's guest, Kevin Wilmot, for joining us. You can learn more about his work and all of our episodes at our website, projection-booth.com.
That's right. And make sure to stop by that projection booth website. Give us your feedback, your comments. Let us know what you think about the episodes. And then swing by iTunes, or you can also subscribe on Stitcher as well and get that streaming right to your mobile device. And leave us a review. Leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher, any way you want to do it. Put some stars on there. Not stars and bars, just stars. And we'll be very...
Just stars.
That's just right. That's right. Just stars. Because that's the universal thing. See, we all have the stars going on. And that would be great. And we would just have to say to you, when you do, we say, yeehaw.
There's a story you should know from 100 years ago, and 100 years we've waited now to tell. Now the Yankees come along, and they'll listen to this song, and they'll quake in fear to hear this rebel yell.
And they'll quake in fear to hear this rebel yell. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again.
Robert E. Lee broke his musket on his knee, and 1,000 pieces shattered on the ground. But he looked up then, and he gathered up his men, and from his lips there came an awful sound.
And from his lips there came an awful sound. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again.
Took a gun and he made the Yankees run, but he took a fatal bullet in the chest. As he fell down dead, old Stonewall said, I'm a giving you a dying man's request.
I'm a giving you a dying man's request. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again.
Spurred his horse and the Yankees ran, of course, but there wasn't any powder for his guns. So he said to his boys, let's make a lot of noise and we'll charge again and make them Yankees run.
And we'll charge again and make them Yankees run. Yee-haw! Oh, the South's gonna rise again. Yee-haw! Oh, the South's gonna rise again.
Robert E. Lee broke his musket on his knee, and 1,000 pieces shattered on the ground. But he looked up then, and he gathered up his men, and from his lips there came an awful sound.
And from his lips there came an awful sound. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again.
A new generation of young people are excited now about owning Negroes. The buying, trading, and selling of servants on the internet has pumped over $500 million into the economy. But behind pornography, it's the top-selling item on the net.